Just a couple minutes early. Hey, we got everything ready to go. Why not go ahead and launch a couple minutes early and get going? And I got a great one for you today. We're going to have Josh Ewing on in just a minute. We're going to be talking to him about recapturing our communities and family legacy through becoming a homesteader. So we're going to talk about his walk as a homesteader, some of the things they've done with greenhouse growing and solar and other stuff like that. And we're also going to talk about how it can affect local economies, how to reach out to your neighbors and a bunch of stuff like that. So this will be a great show because probably the two things we talk about the most to get people excited here, other than gloom and doom, right, is homesteading, permaculture, all that stuff, and community building. So we're going to put those two things together today, and we'll have John on in just a minute because I've been working with Josh Hale so much this week, I keep wanting to call John Josh. So if I accidentally do that during this episode, please forgive me in advance. Including John yourself, who's sitting in the back right now waiting to come in. Before we do that, let's go ahead and take care of some business and our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is canineacademy.us. That's Joel Ryle's educational platform. It's an extension of Fortress Canine, where he trains some of the best protection dogs in the world. But maybe you don't have that kind of money to be investing in a pre-trained dog, or maybe that's not what you're looking for in a dog. Maybe you just want your dog to be a good citizen of your home. Maybe you want it to be the ultimate homestead dog. Maybe you want a dog that's good on your homestead, protects your animals, but it's a house dog, still comes in the house at night. But if your kids are missing on your large property, you want them to be able to find your kids. You can learn all of that and more at canineacademy.us. And I recommend that everybody that goes there at least check out the Problem Solving Library. It's completely free. All you do is sign up for the site, add that course, and you can go ahead and get a free 8-chapter course and see how Joel handles teaching. What could be better? Figure out if this is right for you. Then you might want to move on to the core obedience, because that's where everything comes from. A dog that can do all those fantastic things, tell you what else it can do. It can sit, it can stay, right? It can learn to wait. It can obey its owner. And once it learns that basic skill set, then the sky's the limit how far you want to take it. So the core obedience course is the one I recommend for everybody. With that, let's go ahead and talk about our second sponsor of the day today, and it is Above Phone. Do you know that your phone spies on you, like it legitimately spies on you, like it actually collects data on you and delivers it to like app manufacturers, the government, the device manufacturer, and your carrier? And then all of those entities turn around and sell various components and pieces of your information to whoever wants to buy it. And that they can like shut you off whenever they really want to and cause all kinds of problems for you. How'd you like to make that all go away? With Above Phone, you can. You can have the Graphene OS installed professionally by the folks at Above Phone. You have your own private ecosystem of apps. And I know what you're thinking. I have this one or this two or even these three apps that I have to use for specific things. And they're only available like on Google Play or the iOS App Store. You can still install those. You install them and then you put them in a jail, a little walled off jail. And then they only do what they do when you let them out of jail to do their job. And then when you shut them off and put them back in jail, they can't do that and monitor you anymore. And if you're like, but I don't know if I'll be able to use this newfangled phone. Don't worry. When you get your phone, you get 1 hour of consultation with an Above Phone expert who will walk you through switching over to your new Above Phone. And if you're an MSB member, guess what you get? Yeah, you get $75 off any of the phones available at Above Phone. And then with that, I want to say welcome to John. John, welcome to the Survival Podcast, brother.
It's great to be here. It's an honor.
I'm glad to have you on, man. I know you do come out of our community. You've listened to TSP for quite a while. Before we even dig into that, though, what's your background? Like, before you were homesteading and playing around with solar and even thinking this way, what were you kind of doing with your life?
A lot of this took off because I made the mistake of marrying a hillbilly from the Blue Ridge Mountains area. That's kind of how it started. I know that before that time, I was pretty much just working for Fort Calhoun Nuclear Power for OPPD. We had a federal overreach that eventually came in and kind of shut us down. At that time, after having my first kid, I all of a sudden decided to not really be tolerant of stuff that I thought I was okay with. Yeah, it's funny how that happens, right? Yeah. I hear that story all the time. And my wife kind of already had a vision of what she wanted, and I was smart enough to tag along. I know everyone kind of has, you know, the stories about how they met, but ours is kind of interesting. Basically, after we met, we were only dating for about a month prior to us getting engaged, which kind of freaked out my dad because he just went through a divorce. And I was giving my wife my power of attorney because I was getting ready to get deployed. And he's like, this is a real bad idea, because all of us who's former military have heard how this story works out, right?
Yeah.
And she was active duty Air Force, and I found out I was getting deployed because I was stop loss. And I told her, and she kind of said, well, it would suck if we just went ahead and wasn't married, you know, didn't get married. And so I thought that was kind of, so I came over, proposed, and next thing you know, we end up in a MOB station, I believe it was Fort Leavenworth, Leonardwood. And she, we were going to hold off and get married when I got back. And then when the military decided to redeploy through the north, they wanted to go through Turkey, and Turkey said, we're not playing this game. So we had to redo all our paperwork. And so, I said, well, let's go and do this now. Because we were looking at the benefits, because she's Air Force, who already outranked me by two ranks. And I was just an E4 mafia guy. So, we had to sneak out of the UCMJ allotted area to go back to Nebraska to get married. And I had a squad leader that I told, hey, I'm going to tell you this, but you don't know anything about it. Because I wanted him to be able to not be held responsible if something was going to happen, you know. And I never met this guy. I was a stop loss the whole time. And it worked out well. And then when we got back, I got an option to see her while I was deployed. She was in Qatar and I was in Iraq. And we happened to go back to where the Air Force base was for the Army for R&R. And I think I was probably the only person that said, I just want to see a chaplain. And everyone kind of freaked out because they had all these things for us to do. Yeah. And I was like, my wife is less than a half mile on that Air Force base, and I'm not going anywhere other than that Air Force base. And so we got a hold of her. They came down. I had to be in front of the command sergeant major. We had a long story about how we met, which I'm not going to bother your listeners with. But and their mouth was agape, him and the butter bar, who was the commanding officer for him. And he said, okay, then. And it was funny because the lieutenant says, like, sir, you know what's going to happen if they get off base together. And command sergeant major said, they're married. I don't care. I really don't care. And so, of course, when I got back, this is working the prison in Iraq. I was an MP, 95 Bravo. And before I go any further on that, I am probably the most Scott Horton anti-war person. So don't misalign that. But then when I got back, the MPs were very close niche group, and we work at a small level, and they were quick to point out that, you know, you only dated her about a month before you got here. You probably see me more naked than you have her, you know. And I got harassed because I got a chance to see my wife in a combat zone. But anyways, so we bought an acreage after we got back. My wife designed the house. We had Design Homes, which is a modular company, come out and actually set it. At that point, we got Idaho pasture pigs. We were the first registered. We also did a grid tied system, and the REC, the power company, it was a co-op, didn't really know what to do with us. And so we went ahead and installed the system, and they came down, since the co-op doesn't produce their own electricity, they came down with one of their representatives, my installer, and one of the representatives of the power company. And they were saying, well, you need $1 million rider policy in order to set this up. They're basically putting barriers to entry, right? And so so my insurance agent happened to attend this meeting because I knew where they were going to go with it. And I said, you know, let's all be clear here. Let me ask him, do you ever see a situation once they've signed off on this that we will ever pay this out as an insurance company? And they said, no. And I said, okay, so me getting the alien abduction insurance actually makes more sense than me getting this policy. And he's like, yeah, I don't understand. But anyways, so when we sold that place, we moved about a mile down the road. We had some legal things, which is an interesting story, but I want to save that one for later if we get around to it. But I saw the paperwork that the people who bought our house had to sign in order to keep the system. And there's no way I would have installed it if I was having to deal with that. So when we went to the next house, we already had enough of a history to go fully off grid, because we kind of knew how everything went. And it gave us the opportunity that right probably a few months after COVID started, when I think everyone had a reason to be a little concerned at that time, we held probably 35 people on my front porch for a 3-hour class on DIY solar. which was really supposed to be an hour and a half class until it became a 3-hour class. And so, so I teach solar. I'm trying to get enough under my belt to get Noster at this convention coming up on the 21st and 22nd that the homeowners of Iowa are putting on, Minnetonka. But what I found was really interesting is that I've taught solar a lot, and I typically do it for free because I realize if you really want freedom, I always tell people, like, I got a deployment Kosovo, I got a deployment like Iraq. My wife is a retired mass sergeant. She has all these deployments. But really, I would surrender it all just to make more people free. And the only way you can do that is through homesteading. So we got a chance to teach a class with, I called at the time, Homesteading Where You're At. And through the podcast you did about rabbits, through the podcast of quail. And I'm happy you tolerate the fact your wife doesn't eat any of these things, but you still teach on them. Basically all the small production, I was able to make a class around that. And I'm really hesitant to teach classes that I don't have much experience with, but there was enough material there. I wanted to get it out. I wasn't going to allow that to inhibit me, that this is what you can do even in small areas. And sure. So when we went into that class, I had a lady who, worst case scenario, she had a situation where she was a single mom in an apartment with a kid that had autism. Right. And so I asked her, I'm like, well, what is this kid eating? And kind of already knew. He said, well, you know, she eats chicken nuggets primarily, you know. And I said, well, I understand that if you show up with tomatoes and stuff like that, if they have autism, they really like that structure. They're probably not going to jump in and want to eat vegetables and stuff. So I talked to her about maybe going through a tomato, having him pick the seed, having him pick the soil, actually have him be a part of every single part of it. And then as the tomato gets round, then you talk about how we're going to eat it. And I said, you know, here's the deal. When you never know what the outcome is going to be with that kid if you go through this process. And when we talk about homesteading or we talk about legacy, we talk about the importance of someday we're going to be somebody's ancestor and why that should matter. And if you ever look through all the times in history, and also if you're a biblical fan, you'll see that most people become very controllable once they forget where they come from. And so we did a little exercise, which was really, I didn't realize how much impact it made. We had everybody come into the building that was in that class, and they filled out a note card with somebody in their family that they think about when things get hard or they get motivated. And I said, okay, so we're going to play Hangman, and we had 7 little lines. And if you tell me about this person on this note card, we'll go ahead and I'll let you pick a letter. So we had 7 different people put down, you know, go ahead and go through this process. And the word was legacy. And when I said, you know, there's one, this is where it hit home. I said, you know, we've heard all these great classes. We had everything from people who were part of the Declaration of Independence to people who had farms that didn't exist anymore because now the Missouri runs through it. And I said, there's one common theme in all of these. Not a single one of them had anything to do with money. Yeah. And at that point, you can kind of see it all kind of sit in. I said, it doesn't matter if you're a cashier at Casey's or Greer or Walmart, you can start building legacy. And we kind of talked about what that looked like and why that's important. And as an American middle class, we're all unfortunately sold this consumer model. And we never really think about that there's people that sacrifice so we could be where we are. And what does that look like for our children if we can get our foothold? And what would that be? So
you kind of ran up into where you started homesteading and all. But I know you're also a listener to our show. Where in this did TSP enter? Like, were you guys listening to Floyd and shit? Did we cause this?
No.
You found the idea, then you found us.
No. So this will help date you a little bit. I still support him financially. I don't get a chance to listen to him very often. But when you talked on Pete Quinones' show.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how long ago. You were a little bigger person back then. But you were talking about the story of being like a pig and pushing on the fence, but not busting through.
Okay.
And
that's going back 7-8 years at least.
Yeah.
That would have been like one of the first times I ever did anything with him. So yeah, that would have been way back.
And it was interesting because you were kind of be reserved because you didn't want to offend anybody. And
yeah.
he's like, just come off the hook. And I'm like,
yeah,
I'm like, you know, this guy is speaking truth. And at that point, now when I go running, the only thing that makes me is I typically do 6 miles, and the only way I can get through that insanity is I listen to your podcast. There's a lot of paradigm shifts, even in the ones that I don't really care for. There's always something in there that changes my position. So I have Strike installed on my phone, and I'm waiting for a pay raise, and we're just taking that pay raise and putting Strike for BTC. You did a podcast on Generation Zero that just knocked me out of the park. And like what that looks like. Other than that one and the one that you did, you were talking about getting, I'm trying to think of it, but getting the CO2 out of the atmosphere back into the ground. And you talked about, I totally agree. There's too much of this carbon in the air.
Yeah.
And so, so a lot of times
we don't have it in the soil. That's why,
right? Exactly.
It's not the problem there. It's that we need it here and there's only one place to get it.
Correct. And the nice thing about that is that it goes across both political ideologies.
Yeah.
It becomes nonpartisan at that point.
You'd hope. Now, I still get a lot of people on the left with blowback from that. Like, it's religious. So you didn't say it the right way. So it's not good enough. It's like, I don't know what else to do for you. It gives you what you want. It gives them what they want. It's a perfect solution. So, of course, you reject it. But, you know. That's the horse to water, not necessarily making them drink thing. And for those that are maybe new around here, and when he said it was a bigger guy back then, if you don't know what he was being nice, I was fat. That's what he was being. He was being nice there. So we kind of talked about how you became a homesteader. Like, it was driven a lot by this. I don't mean this way in any way negative. I mean, very positive way, very ideological. There were certain things that needed to change in the world, and there's only one way that you can take charge of changing that for yourself. And then as you do that, you kind of can spread out and help change others. And I think that's kind of the foundation of what we want to talk about today. But eventually, somewhere in all this, you also got into solar. So was that sometimes solar is because we want to be off grid, and so we're choosing it. And sometimes it's because the place we found doesn't have effing power. So we got to spend a lot of money to bring power in, or we can just make our own power. What kind of started your solar journey?
Yeah, so my story is even a little different. We wanted to build a barn on our property, the first property that we had. And my wife, unfortunately, we lost her mom. Awesome woman. Actually spent more time when I was deployed being on the phone with her mom than I did my wife, so I got tore out for that a lot. But and there was money through the IRAs that she had that we couldn't get without any type of tax penalty. And so we are able to basically create a tax credit. And I want to make that clear to your viewers. There's a difference between a tax credit and a tax incentive. Credits when you get to keep more of your money, and incentives when you get somebody else's. And I understand that the Keynesian think there's no difference in that because all your production belongs to them. But it allowed us to get our barn and basically pay for it. And it was funny because the gentleman who originally installed our system he apologized later once I contacted him when I went fully off grid for the cost of what it cost, because it was pretty expensive at the time. And so it was a full chalupa system. I don't know if I'd really recommend that, which basically you're going to have solar, you're going to have battery, you're going to have generator, you're going to have L1 line coming in. It's a very expensive way to do it. But at the time, that's kind of how we got the solar. And it was nice because we are around a lot of little McMansions run by people who were for UP, and kind of the idea why we had to leave. But it was nice having their kids to ask their parents. Well, of course the power's on, because I could go over to, you know, the Ewings, and they got power, and of course they're trying to head off to Omaha, and they, you know, and so which is closer to us as far as escaping. So yeah, that's how we got into it. And then my wife's like, you know, we'll go fully off grid for our house. And I think I need to point this out. I think one of the most misunderstood things about solar is that if you can afford a decent used car, you could probably be fully off grid. We did ours for about $16K. This is me doing everything as far as installing and buying. Uh-huh. And we have the Vivor vacuum sealer. We have the ceiling fans. We have multiple refrigerators and freezers for processing our own meat, microwaves, air fryer, you know, and they got four daughters and they burn through electricity pretty good. So yeah, that's pretty much our solar story.
Very, very cool. So how many ways do you have to heat your home? I know that's something that's an interesting take. And you're, you know, in the northern country, we're like, here, how do I heat my home? I open my drain on the south side of the house in the winter.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, like, there's a lot of things I don't like about this house that are difficult to change because it's built in 1978. The interest rates were 18%. If there was a shortcut, it was taken. But the one thing I got going, I got these huge windows all along the front. And when it was 9 degrees out and our power was off, even though we had supplemental heat, we turned it off. Because just by raising the windows when the sun came, it was 9 degrees outside. It was too warm in the house. We had to put the stream back down. You're not in that situation. Mm-hmm. You deal with cold, long-term cold. So what do you do about your backup for heat?
So, of course, right now we burn wood is our primary. We have an Amish cook stove, Echo, for those who are familiar with that brand, that runs in our kitchen. This year we installed a solar mini split, which basically kind of familiar with like the Mr. Cool DIY mini splits. They use them a lot in Europe. It allows you to directly hook solar panels into it using MC4 connectors, which are the connectors solar uses, and then you have a 220 outlet on the side. This is kind of cool for people who can't do solar where they live. It allows you to offset your cooling and heating needs because it's basically a heater and a cooler. It's a pump. And it's considered an appliance. So it's because it's a heat pump. So, and none of the power goes back to the grid as the sun comes down. It has a little meter that shows you what's being used and it drops back. So when it's sunny outside, we don't burn wood. The other option is that if you're, I don't know if you got a chance to hear Thomas Massey's interview. It was really good for it. If you're just a homesteader and even the political side, he talks about how his homestead is set up. And one of the things he points out at the end of the conversation is they ask him, you know, you're one of the people that don't really take bribes. You don't seem to be interested in a lot of the stuff. And he openly came out and said, it's because everything I want, I have at home.
Ah.
And it insulates him from participating in evil. I'm a big Hoppe and Rothbard type guy, you know, and so I understand that concept. Basically, he has no desire for plunder. So,
yep.
So we have the wood, we have the mini, the heat pump, the mini split. In our Facebook, we got, it's really cool pictures, but my wife, she's actually installing the manifold because we have installed PEX heating in the floor downstairs. Okay. And then we also have a 600 gallon holding tank. This system is all there. We haven't finished installing it, but it uses, and same thing with the interview with Massey, is that it talks about how he uses a resistive load, kind of like what you see in hot water tanks, to heat up this water, and that way it acts like a battery, so it gives you days of autonomy, and all the maps out there for your area, what you need, that allows you to do that. So our stove also has an element that we could eventually get around to install the dump. So we could dump the resistive load water in there, we could dump the load, and those resistive loads are all extra solar panels. And then the hot water tank. And so it will allow us, so I'm hoping eventually we can move off wood almost entirely once we're up and running. So, and then we have, if you come home, if anyone has burned wood, sometimes you come home late, it's like 10 o'clock, like, gosh, I really want to start this up. We also have an LP wall heater, as well. And so a lot of you guys in Texas, when you had your power outage, I think that would have been the thing to save a lot of the people. And they're relatively cheap, under $200.
Yeah.
You know,
not only would it be a good idea, I would say about 50% of the homes in the average subdivision down here already have natural gas right to them.
Yeah.
Even a lot of people that aren't using it, they still have it. You know, maybe they have all electric appliances. So, like, installed, you're talking $800 for somebody else to do.
Oh, yeah. If that, correct.
And it's that's what we use for backup is gas heat. And it's on demand. You turn it on, it starts to get warm instantly.
Exactly.
You know, before you even worry about a generator or anything else, just boom, heat. If you can have heat and light, you can pretty much figure everything else out.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, that's cool. What did you say the name brand of that stove was?
Hecco. H-E-C-O.
H-E-C-O?
Yeah, they replaced, there's a, I think it's Obadiah's Wood Stove. They have a huge, okay. It's a great place for it. They're one of the best YouTube videos too, even if you don't want to buy anything from them as far as information. And they kind of replaced, they had issues with the Kitchen Queen or the Pioneer Queen. And they said, we're not doing this anymore. And they went with Hecco instead.
Okay, so, cool.
Yeah. Cool. The nice thing about the Heccos, yeah, they're easy to clean out. Everything's from the front. You don't have to pull the stove away from the wall, which is one of the big headaches for, and they're very efficient. We've been, ours, you have cast iron that's been enameled on top. They do make them stainless if you want that option. And we also, it has cook stove options. So, cooking with a wood stove is a skill set. I don't think a lot of people understand that. It's a very slow process. So if you want to do, if you spend the money and get some cast iron coated cooking ware, it makes phenomenal food. So.
Okay. Yeah. I really never cooked with a wood stove, but I did a lot of cooking with a coal stove. It's very similar in how you have to adapt to the technology. The main reason I asked is because I thought you said Petco. And, no. and when I tried to search for Petco, it corrected it and tried to show me Petco. And I'm like, no, I only want for my dog. And I wanted to make sure we got that in for people that might have an interest in it. All right. And again, if you guys, we're not going to take this one now, but if you have a question and you're in the live stream, that is the way to do it right there. The way that Jesse just did, put the word question in all caps and we will get to you at the end with your questions. If you don't put it in all caps, there's a good chance my one good eye won't see it. All right. So let's move on. Let's talk about, you talk about recapturing your family legacy. That's what, when I got your app, I was like, man, that's a deep topic. So can you talk about maybe an example of what it means to recapture that family legacy?
Sure. So right now, I have my paid first speaking gig going on the 21st and 22nd up in Ottumwa. And I'm making the slides for this, you know, and I'm going through it. And it's one of the hardest classes that I put together because it's a very personal class. If I don't do a little breakdown while I'm doing it here, I'll be happy by the time. But it's you have to really strip down to people to find out what's important to them. I spent a lot of time in the first part of class of talking about the dangers of a consumption type market. We talk about it. I don't know if you ever seen that art piece where there's a hydraulic arm with a vacuum on it. That its job is to pick. Yeah. So we talk a little bit how that resonates on, you know, all the time that we spend and things that really don't matter. And so I know, so there's an interesting story. My mom, she got remarried, and this gentleman, he's an awesome guy. And he talked one day about writing a book. But he doesn't think anyone's going to read it. And I just happened, my wife has a book on her table that basically talks about her people in the Blue Ridge Mountains during the time of the Civil War. And that book, I've spent some time hearing some stories about it, and my girls understand that they're a part of that. And I told them, you really need to write that book. I go, because somebody wrote that one and they didn't even know I existed. And now I got to be a part of it. And it doesn't matter if anybody reads it or if, it just matters that, are you okay if you die that you actually didn't do it? Mm. And one of my favorite slogans is we may not know our lineage or our ancestors, but you should live the life that they damn well know who you are. So it's basically saying, rather than spending time worrying about your property taxes, you were talking about you had a relative that was really offensive to have property taxes, and you're better off trying to outproduce because they don't tax the ability to produce on your property.
Correct.
That was a take home point. And so, I think children, even if you have some really good religious backgrounds, the family has to have a purpose. Jordan Peterson says, and he says that, hey, you know, they say paradise is a walled garden, you know, and so it allows you to produce while being protected. And I've seen my kids, I have a daughter who would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go work at an old folks home to provide food because she earned the credits to do that. And she was so enamored by her ability to make her own money that she's willing to suffer to make it happen. So I think if you have a family that has a purpose, and I think most homesteaders need that. They see it. I see you talk with your grandson before, right after you give him a hard time about something, you know, something on his way. That's the problem. I don't have any sons, so trust me, I miss that, but I have four daughters. But by building that purpose in your family and struggling, your kids will see it too. So we have my second oldest. She has a boyfriend. He's a Hispanic guy, awesome guy. But he's never had a homestead to work on. And now when he comes over to our house, he's out splitting wood with my wife at 10 o'clock while I'm working on something else. And you can see the sense of purpose, you know, that he has inside. That is just, he's like, I don't know why he goes, this is like why I'm supposed to be here, you know. And I think once you forget your purpose, and once you forget that you're willing to struggle for these purposes, you become more of a pond and your children become more of a pond. And so right now, and I'll kind of lend this to the greenhouse and the snow. If any of you guys ever get a chance to head out to Alliance, Nebraska, they do free walkthroughs. I think it's crazy that I'm hoping my grandkids thinks it's normal that in Iowa it's 60 degrees inside this greenhouse and we're growing pineapple. Because they already do it in Alliance, Nebraska. It's not that big of a deal. And so I'm trying to normalize things. So as this goes on, your kids have something to attach them to. And even when they get married, those might not be people that are directly attached. They'll still attach to it. And so it also gives you something to suffer for. I think love is a verbal testament of your willingness to suffer for something. You know, and that definition gets me in trouble because somebody goes, well, I love my children. And I say, okay, cool. Do you acknowledge that maybe the public schools aren't that great? And they're like, yeah. And I go, well, what are you suffering for to make that education better? You know, and that's not what people want to hear. And the hard part is, the hard part is that you have to know your audience because you're going to cut right through to the truth of the matter. And like when somebody wants to hear it, if I'm doing my job right and they're doing their job right, we're probably both in tears. But most people, they just get really upset unless because they're not ready to hear it. But at the end of the day, this is our life. I mean, you get this time and then you got to decide when you die and you get a chance to find out what you were capable of doing, if you're okay with what you find out about what you could have been or who you could have been or what you could have done. So,
you know, while you were talking there, the word that kept coming in my head was anchor. So like a ship doesn't use its anchor that much, but it really, really, really has to have one. And if you send a ship out to sea and into various ports and things like that with no anchor, it is going to have a problem. And so these homesteads become the anchor, the grounding point for the family, the grounding point for the family's mission. So even when the ship's out of port and out doing stuff, it remembers its purpose. And the crew remembers the purpose of what we're doing in the first place. Like no one wants to always be at sea. At some point, you want to come home and throw that anchor out and be linked to something. And that's a really cool way of looking at things.
Yeah, and I think as homesteaders, we talk a lot about the how we do it. Most of your podcasts, and I think a lot of people don't understand the weight of it, what they're actually doing. I the gravity just misses us. I had a group that I went to 2 hours away, and they were at one of my classes, and they were already setting up news points and bulletins and classes. And this is somebody who's bought a storefront, and they're doing everything to drive back. We have a small production of food going on down at Logan, just down the road, one farm, and they're getting bigger. And the thing is a lot of these small towns want to be more like bigger towns like Omaha, and they put all these initiatives, and you look at them, and every initiative just screams more taxes. What we don't understand is like, look, I've been to the Virginia, I've been to the East Coast. There's a lot of small towns that they drive traffic in from larger towns because they have niche products that they sell or basically agriculture. And that's really the vision. That's how you keep your kids there. That's how you basically build these little Jeffersonian republics is basically through that rather than trying to be more like Omaha. And it's just a lack of vision, you know? So,
I was doing some research recently about, well, how big do you build a community? How big do you build a town before it starts to lose what makes it great. And it depending on how you look at it, it's somewhere between about 8,000 to 15,000 people. And that's pushing it already. But when you get a town much over 15,000 people, it becomes a city. And then all of the problems with being a city come. All of the regulations, all of the, well, we can't let that happen. All of the city problems start at about that number. The other side of it, though, is you go much below about 3,000 or 4,000 and you don't have enough resources to keep everything going. And then everybody has to rely on going outside for everything that comes in. So you have consistent financial entropy. So your money's always leaving. It's not staying in a circular economy. And the children leave because there's not enough opportunity. That's going on in farm country like crazy right now. Farmer's got 4,000 acres. He can barely make a living. He certainly can't break off a block and give it to his kid. So the kid goes to college, the kid comes home, the kid looks around, and the kid leaves. And so there's a point where you go too small, and it creates this giant sucking sound like remember Ross Perot and NAFTA, giant sucking sound, right? Mm-hmm. How it goes. And then there's this really kind of this need to develop enough going on that people stick around, and then some level of sanity of, but we don't want, like you said, you don't want to be Omaha. Right. I don't know what the population of Omaha is, but I'm sure it's more than 15,000.
Yeah. I think a lot of that has to do with actually building culture, yes. Especially with a lot of those problems. And you've kind of addressed it before in other podcasts, is that through Nostra and Bitcoin Exchange, I think we can make that number maybe even smaller, because the ability to have those options, to those resources as far as money. And I mean, the world is your market now. I mean, that's really kind of where we're at. And so, like with my kids, I already have daughters. They're already talking about, okay, so when we take over this and dad moves up to the other part of the property, how are we going to run it? You know? And so you start seeing the community being built, because there's a central ideologically, and you know, I got to make a little bit of announcement here. This, I'm supposed to be the fourth district coordinator for the Libertarian Party, but the problem is it's hard for me to do politics stuff when I could fix the answers myself on my own property.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, the ideology, that the freedom in their local areas, where the answer isn't always just more taxes. How do we fix this? You know, we joke, they just build a huge dome, a sports dome onto our school. And I'm like, well, how much more levels of intelligence are we going to be because of this? Yet you can walk outside the school and throw a rock any direction and hit a cornfield, but yet we're eating modified starches for lunch every day for the lunch thing, because it's, well, that's how we get our federal funding, you know? And it really pisses me off, because it's like these, you didn't even have a greenhouse in the back. I'm like, how much food do we get out of that greenhouse that they could possibly, you know what happens to kids when we start growing stuff, and they're kids that pick on them actually enjoy what they're eating, how they feel about themselves. I mean, it's a small town that doesn't understand what resources it actually has available to itself.
Well, what did they do? They squander the resource potential for the dream of something else, right? Because what you have, and this is very common in farming country, you have all these farms everywhere growing all this food, and almost no food that anybody eats comes from where they live. Even the corn that they are eating went 5,000 miles round trip before it came back in a box as syrup. Right. Like, you have no idea where your food came from, and you're surrounded by farms.
Yes.
This was not even unthinkable. It was, no one would even understood what you were saying 50 years ago.
Yes.
You said in 50 years, people will live surrounded by farms, but all their food will come from outside where they live. They would have looked at you like you were the most retarded human being on planet Earth and asked you what your problem was. They would have never understood what you were talking about. Today, we have that everywhere. And that's because people are always doing things for this dream that they're chasing, but it's an ungrounded dream. It has no semblance of reality. So one day we'll have enough federal money that what? And then what are you going to do with the federal money, and how will that make the life of people who live here better? If we don't grow all corn, we don't have something we can immediately sell to a person that we don't even know at a market rate. And if you do that, then what? You'll get to barely make it another year, and you'll have nothing left to leave your children, and you'll make sure that you bring in just enough outside money to elevate your real estate prices so that your grandchild can ever buy a house? Is that the goal? Because that's what you're doing. So I've been, this is interesting because I've been playing with this idea, and I've actually been using AI to do some analysis. Mm-hmm. So I got some of these numbers from. And one of the concepts is that you reach this point where community develops, and if it's going to keep people around, you get into this break point where if you don't grow, you start to collapse. And if you grow, then you outgrow everything and you ruin everything. And one of the things that I've kind of come up with is I think what we need are like small towns that are federated so that within driving distance, there's all these little towns and they all keep their own charm and their own culture and their own entity. But if, you know, you need something and it's not in town A, it's over in town B, and that's only a 15-minute drive. And that way, when you kind of grow something to a limit, then people can begin to develop another area, because otherwise you just either end up, because I've seen the other side. Like, it sucks when you overgrow, but I've also seen what happens when you don't. I've looked at towns, and you can just look at them and go, this used to be really cool. This used to be awesome. There used to be a lot of stuff going on here. And now Main Street has trees growing through the roof of the building, and you track somebody down and go, when did this happen? They're like, oh, 10 years ago. You went from 10 years to hopping to trees growing through Central Supply Store, right? Like, and I saw that all over Arkansas, all over Louisiana on one of the driving trips we took. I've seen it all across the country. And you can understand a young person growing up and going, Dad, Mom, I'd love to stay here, but what am I going to do? And so we have to build, and yet we have to limit. That's kind of crazy.
I think one of the arguments that towns could probably have, and it sounds like a bridge too far a little bit, but we're doing it on my property, is that the idea that we can have consumer-based retirement is insane. And I'm doing the Prospero thing, but is that, so think about it. You save an unknown amount of money that's going to have an unknown amount of value to buy an unknown amount of quantities of product to hopefully offset the unknown amount of inflation and also pay an unknown amount of taxes. And this is our 401k Dave Ramsey model. And I don't have anything against, as much as I do, nothing matters until you're financially out of debt.
Yep.
As far as homesteading. I mean, it's just a distraction if you're not out of debt. But like our greenhouse in the snow, there's a guy, I think he's even further north than us, and all he does is, I think he does spinach, and he's always out. And so part of our greenhouse, we're going to do a day neutral strawberries on the backside, because we can do them year round. And hopefully it'll pay enough that we can have a separate one just for our own consumption and the one for sale. But that's our retirement. Mm. I mean, so it's, if you had people who were basically switched from the consumer model to the production model, not only will it give purpose, but they're more likely to, lack of better terms, deal with Rome falling, because they'll actually be a remnant. A lot of people understand that when those towns fall, there's people on the outside that aren't really impacted. They're remnants of what it is. And that's really should be the goal politically, economically, rather than thinking we're going to stop this from happening, is really just kind of individual secession, I guess, is if you're kind of a Mises guy. And so,
Yeah, individual secession is something I talked about many, many years ago. It's a mindset, and then you have to actually do the work, because one of the ways you can do it, like you said, is with some sort of a production model that creates an income source instead of just trying to save enough money to pay for things. You don't know how much you're going to have. You don't know how much it's going to cost, and you have all these variables that can change it. Like, well, my electric bill is X, right? Well, everybody in Texas got a real wake-up last year. We were deregulated. We all had very, very low interest rates. And as people's contracts ran out, your electric bill went up like 65%. Like, most people have seen that happen. You didn't use more power. You didn't become irresponsible. That's just how much it costs now. So then everybody's out trying to, you know, bring in solar and stuff. Well, if you build the infrastructure for energy and then you know how to maintain that infrastructure, and all you have to do is maybe fix a part or two, I guess what I'm saying is it's not buy once, cry once, but it's cry really hard one time. Maintaining that system's a lot less expensive than doing it all over again from the beginning. And now you're going into retirement, whatever that even means anymore, with, well, I'm not paying my electric bill because I don't have one. Right. Or with not, like, water, sewer, I don't know what you're talking about. About once every 5 years, I give a guy a few $100 to pump my septic. And I that's it. That's all I do. Hopefully I won't have to stick another well pump on anytime soon. That was a hard pill to swallow, but that pump was 29 years old. Right. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't complain about it. We pulled it up because it was from the previous house owner. We looked at it. We got the date on it. And he goes, yeah, man, you can't really do better than this, you know? And it was the same dadgone pump. They still make it. So I'm like, yeah, put another one just like that on back down in there. And so as you build food production, energy production, you have a home that's paid for, et cetera. Now retirement looks different because it's not, I hope I have enough money to make it till I die. It's like you said about Massey, most of what I need, I have. Correct. Most of what I want, I just have. And therefore, everything else is more like being comfortable, helping my children, helping my grandchildren. If you're lucky, maybe you're helping your great-grandchildren get started, things like that. Instead of, I can't tell you how many people I've seen, they had really nice homes when they were in their middle age, you know, and I was a kid, and I watched them age, and I watched them sell their big home and move into this tiny-ass house in a subdivision somewhere or into, like, assisted living or whatever, and they end their life alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sucks, you know. Even if they had something kind of like I have now, like they couldn't keep up with it. Like you have to build it with the intent that one day maybe nobody's doing a lot anymore. Like how can you build the thing so it's easy to maintain? It's easy to get around on. Like we have to start thinking, like one of the things I've become acutely aware of by doing these workshops is my audience is aging just like me. We all are aging. Like you look at the crowd that comes in, you're like, man, I remember when we were all up at like 4 a.m. still partying and we were all 40 mm-hmm. and like, gee, we're all in our 50s and 60s now. And like, except for like 3 hardcore idiots, everybody's in bed by 11. You know, it's like the world, you cannot escape that biological entropy at all. So you have to build with it in mind from an income standpoint, from a resource standpoint, from an infrastructure standpoint.
Yeah, there's, you know, the model. And I might piss some people off on this, but the idea where, you know, everyone saw you on Facebook, and I'm kind of a Michael Malish troll, if you're familiar with his, his artwork, for lack of better terms, is that you'll get this picture that will show a janitor out there doing his work, and it says, you know, any man that is working hard to feed his family is doing great. I don't believe that we were put on this earth just to make the bills. Okay. I personally don't give myself credit for doing things that animals do. Animals take care of the young. They build a house. They do that. That's not legacy. The question is, what does he do when he gets home? It's not bad that he's a janitor. It's none of that's awful. It's just, if just getting by is enough, you're not, I don't care what that country song is. You didn't do it, man. What were you doing? Well, I always joke, if you want to find out why somebody won't homestead and you listen long enough, you'll find out what their favorite Netflix movie is. You'll find out what their sport is or what their favorite alcohol is. So really, it's this, well, if I can just live long enough to pay the bills and stuff. And you were talking about what is retirement. So you're not going to be wanting to suffer because you're afraid you're going to die. That's not enough. If you're saying, look, I'm not just doing this because I want to have one in my retirement. I want to build a legacy. You really have to look beyond your own retirement. Like, what does this look for my grandkids, you know? And so it's, if you're just like, well, I'm just going to, you know, have a nice house and hopefully retire and things are comfortable. Okay. And then, you know, in a few generations it's as if you never lived anyways. And so I'm really not really interested in what you have to say, because you don't care enough about how your great grandkids are going to be. So I guess, you know, I was trolling a guy, and I was like, let me just be honest with him. And I looked on his Facebook page, because that's what trolls do. And he was a big sports car guy. Normally, I don't do that to everybody. He was a big sports car guy, which is fine. You know, I'm all about having purpose as a mechanic. Trust me, I kind of work in that area when I'm at the job that I work to pay for taxes. And I said, you know, maybe you need to be more concerned about the fact that just owning nice cars isn't going to matter once you're gone. And you should really be more concerned about if you're leaving a legacy behind for them. Because I don't kind of see anything. And I was just kind of talking about it. Man, he got real triggered real quick. And it was like, I mean, he didn't really take off until I said, do you ever wonder who went through suffering and sacrifice that you could be here today in the condition you are now, and ask yourself, would they do it again? You know, and that's really when he came unhooked. So but once again, if you forget where you come from, you end up, you know, participating in things that aren't going to matter. And so at least my opinion, but.
So. Yeah. I think that we are in a place now that partially was set up by the generational sequence of handoffs, and then at the same time coming off of a hard money standard. So a lot of people, when they hear the GI generation, they're thinking about the people that were young and fought World War II. And kind of it was really more the GI generation was old, right? They were the generals, right? They're, and maybe like the youngest of them were frontline soldiers. The silent were the people that were, you know, hitting 18 in 1943. Mm-hmm. And that group of people that actually fought the war, they fought the war, they came home, they were the greatest generation. They had another 20-odd years, almost 30 years of real money. And then so during that period of time, we built all sorts of things into the system. We expanded Social Security. We created all these programs that benefited them. Then we had in 71 the fiat glut. So the fiat glut actually benefited us early on, and it's only now, 50 years later, starting to kick our ass. So they got both. They got the hard money. They got all the programs that came. They got all the recognition. They got the GI Bill. They got the college fund. They got the highway system, blue-collar workers making money. And then they got the glut in kind of their older years of the fiat boom, and then they died. And it created this whole, and they, you know, these were the first people that lived in retirement communities, entire subdivisions of nothing but people in their late 50s, early 60s and 70s with like almost a theme park environment. And they create this new artificial standard that no one had ever seen before for retirement, like working class people retiring like rich people did 100 years ago.
Correct.
Right. Like retirement wasn't even in our heads. If you go back into the 30s and back, it was more like you had multi-generational homesteads, multi-generational farms, multi-generational households. And as you got older, you just kind of backed up and did less physically intensive things as your contribution. Like the old man knew how to fix the tractor, but maybe the 14-year-old kid came out and did the work while the old man pointed, right? Like that, right. That was retirement. You know, I don't know that my grandfather ever, you know, financially retired, sure, Social Security, all that, but I don't know that he ever really quit until he just couldn't anymore. But a lot of people did that were in his generation, and then it created this new idea that you kids grow up, they leave, that's it, you're out, right? You're still my kid, but you're out, and mom lives over here, and son and daughter-in-law live over here, and then your retirement's really great in your old age, and your kids are kind of on their own at the point raising their kids, and that's just the way it is. And this has never been the way things were in history. Nothing like that was ever. There is no other society. There's no other time in history where people lived in that isolated fashion. So now the cost of doing that doesn't work anymore.
Mm-mm.
But we're still in that model, right?
Correct.
So then you get old people that think that's their future. They do all the right things. They put their 10% into 401ks or whatever. And, you know, then they get there and then they realize I can do it. But every 10 years, let's say, the quality of that life is knocking down about 5% and has been for about 25 years.
Correct.
There's about 2000. We've about every 5 years, we're knocking down about 1% a year in quality of life. That's 25%, but compounded, right? Like, and that's where we are. And like the only way out of it is either somehow you got to restart the whole financial shenanigans again without blowing everything up, or you have to admit it's a failure. You have to start rebuilding the means by which we build our families and our lives and build our future. When I say our future, I don't mean like 5 years from now, right? I mean, for if you're young, I mean 40 years from now, 50 years from now, right? Like we have to start. Remember the question they always just ask in a job interview, where do you see yourself in 5 years? The question should be, where do you see yourself in 40 years? That we don't have that long time preference at all anymore. And so what's happened is our most elderly people have become fucking disposable.
Correct. We wear
house
elderly.
Even if you don't
elderly.
Feel that way personally about your parents, everybody else does. And you feel that way about everybody else's parents. And I don't mean you in particular, right? I'm talking about the average person. Like, well, they should be good. Their house is paid for. I don't know, right? I mean, I know they raised me and wiped my ass and everything. I may have to do that for them in the end. But overall, like, they're happy. I'm happy. I got my own shit to worry about. And then that person, you know, you can make that person look like they're not a great person, but really what they're thinking is, I've got three kids. How the fuck am I going to make sure I pay my, you like, they're
right,
at that
right.
And they're thinking, well, you had it easy, dad, right? You know, because how do you raise your kids too? You shelter them from all that shit.
Yeah.
So that 45-year-old man right now with three kids, one's fixing to go to college, et cetera, is thinking, dad's got this, man, because dad always pretended like he had this. And you have this complete disconnection across the generations, and you wonder why we're confused.
Yeah, and unfortunately, if you look at how that started, is that during you can blame the industrial military complex that basically centralized the production of food, and at that point you lost a lot of the small homesteads, and it's pretty sad state of affairs when it comes to such a thing. So, but yeah, it's you're definitely right. We warehouse our elderly. Because they don't seem to really be a purpose to their children, and they're all over God's green earth. But on the other hand, it's like, okay, so outside of you as a parent being someone who pays the bills, who are you to me?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I keep you around? You know, and it's sad. It's unfortunate.
Let's pull back into something I know is a deal with you, because you mentioned it already, and I've got it here in the notes for your interview. Why did you pick using, quote, a greenhouse in the snow kit?
Yeah. So I call it the greenhouse in the snow because that's actually the kit and the name of the company that makes it. Let's talk a little bit about this, because I found this funny, because the last time I taught a solar class, all we did was speak about the greenhouse. And granted, 50% of the people were Amish at the time, so maybe that had something to do with it. But so basically the way the greenhouse works, and a lot of people are kind of familiar, like a wall of peony or anything like that, is that they have a first, and my wife knows the statistics, so if I seem a little low on that part, this is kind of her thing, but you basically dig this huge, I call it a tube bed. So for every square foot of greenhouse, you have so many feet of corrugated tubing.
Okay.
And what that does is that you have the one tube at one end of the greenhouse, the tube at another, and then you have this tube bed that sits outside the greenhouse and goes underneath the frost line. So anyone who's ever done with hot water heaters, instant ones, knows that the ground temperature of where you live is the average mean temperature of outside. Okay. So for Iowa, and I didn't know this, like if you go to Florida, you can get a smaller on-demand hot water heater because your ground temperature is a lot higher than, of course, in Iowa. So it's at 52, 53 degrees that air will be pulled into that greenhouse all the time.
Okay.
And it's what we found out when we went there, and this is our second time going there. The first time we went, it was probably like negative 12, and I wanted to see it in its worst condition, right?
Okay.
And we went in there, and the guy, elderly man who at the time ran the company, he was saying in the 15 or 20 or however many years, he's only had to heat it artificially 7 times, and he has orchids and things growing in there. And he says, really what kills you is the amount of solar hours you have at our I want to say latitude, or maybe it's longitude, but beside the point, is that he says when citrus grows in Iowa, it's actually better for it because these plants will grow this fruit and it will hold on to the fruit and it just gets bigger and bigger. And he's had lemons and oranges that he's had out for a year or two, you know, so it allows you to decide when you bring your product to the market. It also, you can say that, it's, you know, organic because you're not spraying it with anything for the most part, because you don't have bugs issues. We will probably run little local tortoises in ours to eat certain bugs, but that's beside the point. And so, and you, no one's bringing, citrus to the market for local, stores. So I don't remember the quote. It was some huge number. He said, but every square foot in this greenhouse is worth this much amount of money to me and how it produces. And so we went back the second time after we actually saw it the first time. And for anybody who wants to see some pictures, you can, if you have a Facebook account, and if you don't, that's great. I worked in 2 third world prisons, Iraq and Kosovo, and I didn't lose my faith in humanity until I got a Facebook account.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of, if you got one, don't have one, that's awesome. More power to you, but beside the point, is that we have pictures of when we were in there, but we went back a second time. And at that point, what they've done is that rather than excavate this huge separate area to run all these tubes back and forth, they now have it where if you want to, you can basically go down 10 feet and you can run flexi tubes as you would for like geothermal.
Yeah.
And they have basically water to air heat exchanger.
Yep.
And then they also offer a swamp cooler, which you guys in the South get to enjoy because I'm too humid. So swamp coolers. And then they have blowout.
You know, there's no swamp cooling here.
Right. You have too much humidity.
You go to West Texas, you can go nuts with that. The time of year where it's dry enough to use one, you don't need one.
Gotcha. It's not that hot, huh?
Yeah.
So anyway, so yeah.
Actually, you know what? They do work to a degree in a properly controlled greenhouse just because we get so hot in the summer. So, but I'm saying like swamp coolers, like if you go out to Lubbock, there's literally people using a big old swamp cooler outside their house, cooler house, right? Like you can't pull that off where we are. It's too humid. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyways, so and then they have these huge tilt-out blow-up panels that kind of work on RV motors. And one of the hard problems that they had with the traditional tube model is that a lot of the customers wouldn't take seriously the ventilation issues required when you're bringing in this cooler air. So they had issues with if you didn't, you'd be constantly fighting mold.
Yeah.
But the system that they have now, it's almost automated. The panels tilt out at a certain time. The swamp cooler does its thing. The heat exchanger does its thing. And of course our system is going to be fully off grid because that's what I do. And it will give my students who are coming out for classes a chance. And I do put on classes, to actually play with it. And so, it's originally, and I tell the story a little bit, originally, we were only going to do a 76 footer, which is about as small as you can get to create. Because you got to remember, you're creating an ecosystem. You know, that is a term I know you like to use a lot for what we try to do as homesteaders.
Yeah.
But you're creating an ecosystem. And at anything less than 72 feet, it's really like having too small of an aquarium. We have that in common. I had to give up. That's the only thing I had to give up by being fully off grid was running, 3,000 watt heaters in a greenhouse that's heated with wood doesn't really work that great on a 70 or bigger tank. But beside the point, but with the it's almost all automated with this system, and it'll be running fully off grid. So with 72 feet, it's the smallest you can get. We actually went it up with a 96 foot. It's 10 feet wide, and then you have the walk space and you have shelving, the elevated. So if you look on our Facebook page, you'll see where we're actually working on the shelving. And then I've really kind of gone off the scope with using the worms for composting. The word escapes me at this point. But a lot of what we'll be doing is we'll be underneath where you walk back and forth. We'll be running our boards underneath there where we can get all our dirt and all our worms and vermicomposting to do with that. And so a lot of times people, they can do bumblebee houses if you have stuff that needs to be pollinated. I do beekeeping. I have done for 10 years. But bees, once they get in a greenhouse, they have their, and Jackie probably knows this, they have their oculi on top of their head that basically is their three dots that help them navigate properly.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work all that great in a greenhouse as far as navigation.
No.
So, but bumblebees do. And the reason bumblebees, their navigation is different. And what a lot of people don't understand is for tomatoes, chickens and tomatoes are the end drug for most homesteaders.
Yeah.
Everyone knows something about their favorite, one of those two things. But
yeah.
Bumblebees, they pollinate tomatoes, but they do so by actually shaking the plant at the pitch of C, and then the pollen comes down them and then et cetera, and that's how that works. But so we've done the excavation, we've backfilled, we wanted to get all the shelves up. We got that done before the winter has gotten here. And then we're in the process of, once the winter clears and the ground unfreezes, which is something we have to enjoy in Iowa, we'll start putting on all the rest of the poly and you have these metal struts that go on everything. And yeah, that's kind of where we are right now.
So, I will tell you, the one thing you can also do for pollination in greenhouses that works really well is mason bees.
Oh, yeah.
They're all chill, and they don't sting, and you give them some boxes and tubes, and you got to make sure they have some mud because they can't do their thing without mud. But, man, they're fantastic. And, the one thing about running them in a greenhouse environment, you won't run into the problem with, like, the leafcutter bees taking over the mason bees' hole.
Ah.
Right? Because they can't get in, right? Or, maybe some get in, but not a lot. Like, you can always get some pests in a greenhouse. People think people think there's none, but there can be some. But I would imagine, like, the guy in Nebraska that was used to do citrus, I think he's passed. But there's probably not a lot of pests that bother citrus in Nebraska. Right? It's just not there. So it's not your greenhouse. It's just like the thing they live on, in there, right?
Yeah, mites are the main problem.
Mites.
And there's ways to deal with those. And so,
ladybugs would be one. Yeah. Traps is another. But, like, I think one of the really cool things about this is there's a lot of people that try to do kind of the farm stand, farmer's market, sell to the neighbors thing in the country. And so you're already at a disadvantage with someone like me for what I can produce to sell, because I'm in this urban rural fringe where, like, north of me, there's nobody, but like that way, that way, that way, there's like 6 million people. So they'll drive 30, 40 minutes to get here to buy stuff for me. I don't have to do anything. So, but you're in a small town, you don't have a big city nearby, then you already don't have as big of a base. And then most of the people that care about tomatoes and peppers and onions and stuff like it grow, right? So now you're trying to sell the thing that the people that actually care about the thing already have. Yeah. And I saw this big time when I lived in Hot Springs, Arkansas for a couple of years, where you'd go down the farmer's market and every single person was like, peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers. And they're trying to even hustle some business. Some of them are like, man, I got all of that. Like, I didn't come here for that. I came here for something different or unique or whatever. Or, you know, you go to that farmer's market in February, maybe I would buy peppers and tomatoes if I don't have a greenhouse, right? But they're not there. Now, if you could start selling things out of season time and out of region there, now you got something, right? Now you can kind of springboard off of that, and you actually don't care if there's – you actually want competition. This is another thing people do not understand, because you build markets when you have competition. I don't even see it as – at that level, it's not even competition. It's actually assistance. And what I mean by that is I've seen places even in big cities, right? So you have this kind of suburb that's, you know, outside – not even a suburb, like a whole other, like, smaller city or town. And it's like a suburb of like Dallas or Fort Worth. And when they start building it, everybody has to drive the city to go to the restaurant. They finally put one restaurant in. You think it's going to explode and do huge business. And it does for like 3 weeks. And then everybody went to the new restaurant. And the new restaurant, let's say, is a steakhouse. And everybody had a steak. Well, I want to go to a chicken place. I want to go to a Thai place, right? Eventually, they become what we call restaurant rows. I don't know how international or national that term is, but down here, that's what they call it, a restaurant row. You end up with like 10 restaurants. And you would think they would be dividing that business up and that they're all their business will go. But no. Everybody's business, unless somebody sucks, right? If somebody just does a bad job. But if they're all good restaurants, everybody's business, rising tide, all boats thing, because now there's choice. And now there's an expectation that if we're going to go out to eat, we're going to stay here because we have lots of choices. So son of a gun, they make one of those choices out of the whatever's available. Yes. And I think in a lot of places, local produce and things like that, there's not enough of it to maintain the market. So if we can start producing more, we can actually, because we're back to where we started. You live in corn country, corn, beans, probably sugar beets, probably barley, wheat, right? Spring wheat coming up, stuff like that, all over the place. Nobody's food comes from across the street. Everybody's food comes from Winco or Winn-Dixie or whatever, and all that food came from a warehouse in California or New York.
Correct.
Because it's not there.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, they'll ask, well, what's the difference between a homesteader and a farmer? And my troll answer is well, inside my refrigerator, my tomatoes don't say Mexico on them.
We'll say Mexico.
Yeah, and so I mean it's, you know, and you've talked about it once already about the kid coming back from college where the farmer gives him an acre or two and he's making more money, and that happens all the time, and that's really what we should, you know, if you want your kids to stay, you gotta give them a reason to, and just selling a product that, as you said, 60% of it doesn't even get consumed is not something that's going to get keep kids here.
Yeah, so. Corn, 60% of it turns into fuel.
Yeah,
or exactly. What is consumed is not consumed as corn. It's consumed as high fructose corn syrup, right? Yeah. Those two things to me are not corn. Those are not corn. We have this plant. It's called a beet. You just squeeze it, and then you make sugar, right?
Correct.
Nah, fuck that. We're going to make it out of corn.
Yeah.
Right? Here's this giant, huge, intensive industrial process to pull the sugar out of corn, and right next to it we could be growing a plant that's like 80% sugar that requires almost no effort to turn into sugar. You got to believe there's something going on the back end for that to be a thing, right?
Like, yeah. There's an article, and you might have to dig for it to find it. It used to be real prominent, called Corn-Fed Blubber. There was a company out there called Biotest. They were making supplements, and they used to have a magazine. But it goes in there and he's actually talking about his dog. You think he's talking about himself because he's it actually talks about how Americans used to drink their corn, like for alcohol, like they'd have breaks during their lunches. But now it says this is what happens. And it basically talks about the majority of the obesity problems, which you pointed to is corn syrup and how it's really messing up our omegas and all the rest of the stuff. And it's a really, you know, it's a really good troll information article. When people talk about obesity, I always try to see if I can find it and stick it in there. And I'm really interested. No one knows, but if the FDA thing does the Robert Kennedy thing, I have no idea what the markets are going to look like in my area if they start cutting back on the use of corn. And that's not an argument to keep it. Don't get me wrong. I get pissed that they use my water from my aquifer and I still have to compete for that and for a product I don't want for my gasoline that puts water in my gasoline. But yeah, it's a good article if you ever get a chance to find it. And so T-Nation, BioTest, it's called Corn Fed Blubber. It's great. It talks about how we used to use it versus how we use it now.
What's funny is what the word corn fed used to mean. When I was in the Army and you said somebody was corn fed, you meant they were strong. They were
big. Yep.
Right? They were strong. Like I remember like there was something going on one time. It was a bunch of guys trying to, get like a lug nut off of a deuce and a half or something. And they had a cheater pipe. There's like two of them. Like, fuck out of the way. And I went over. And it was one that was a black dude. And he's like, look at this corn fed motherfucker. Right
here.
It was a good thing. Right now, corn fed is like a fat pig.
Yes.
You know, that's an interesting little thing we picked up on there. But yeah, I think we need a lot more going on in these small communities. And like the place to start is food because who doesn't eat?
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't eat? And like, there's the old thing, you know, Bill Mollison said many, many years ago, food security is security.
Mm-hmm.
When you have food security, everything takes care of itself, even if you have a shitty version of it. Like the reason that you can walk down most streets in America and not have somebody run up to you, stick a gun in your mouth, put you in the back of a car and send your finger to your family and say, when you give us 10 grand, we'll give them back. Is because we have food security.
Correct.
Even if it sucks, like you can eat ramen noodles. Like you don't almost no one starves calorically. Like nutritionally, we have starvation everywhere, but calorically, we don't have a caloric starvation problem in America. We have an obesity problem in America. Take your ass to a country where that's not the case. Take your ass to a country where 50% of people or more worry if they will eat tomorrow. And then don't look like you belong there and walk down a street and you see what happens. Your finger's going to your wife. That's what's going to happen. If you stabilize that place with food security, because where it's been done, where people have gone in and done the work, and instead of throwing them money and telling them like to go into these project houses or whatever, where they've actually gone in and the relief workers have gone in and trained these people to produce food, it's not that they're bad people in of itself. It's what people will do when they can't feed their kids.
Correct.
And the whole thing, I'm not going to say it's perfect. I'm not going to say you're going to walk down the street and not risk losing a finger, but your odds go way down when that happens.
Yeah, scarcity is the cornerstone of most conflict.
It is.
We talk about it in the legacy classes that if you take a time to pull up the map and see which countries have the lowest unliving yourself, because I'm not sure where you're going to put this. We'll just call it that way.
Yeah.
Is that it's the countries that have the most conflict. You see these places that these people, and the reason they're not unliving themselves is because they have, it's kind of hard to be worried about depression when you're trying to put food in your kid's mouth, or because basically have purpose, for lack of better terms, regardless if you think it's good, bad, or indifferent. Because hell is being successful in your life and feeling empty and purposeless. And I think a lot of people, and that's why that situation where people do that to themselves is a first world problem. You don't see it outside of first world problems. My wife, she served the mission in Ecuador, and she's like, you know, these people, we eat guinea pig and June bugs. But, you know, which is an Army guy, that sounds interesting, you know, beside the point. But they're happy. And they have purpose because they have family and they know where they're going and they know what their role is and they know what it's going to look like and they know where the grandmother is and they know, you know, and so that's really, if it, a lot of people are like, do you want to have things or do you want to have purpose? You know, and you pick your poison. You're going to suffer for either which one. This idea that we can think, oh, we're going to live this great life where we flush potable water down the toilet, that we're going to somehow not suffer.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case, because the regrets you're going to have to deal with when you come to that conclusion is just going to be just as worse as if you would have done something about it when you had an opportunity to do so, or even worse. So.
Yeah, here's a Bill Mollison quote that fits perfectly what we've been talking about for the last 25 minutes. We are only truly secure when we can look out of our kitchen window and see our food growing and our friends working nearby.
That's awesome.
I mean, that dude had an ability to take like a 25-minute conversation we just had, condense it into a sentence, and leave nothing out. Like, just like, bro was the original ChatGPT with an Australian accent. Yeah, he really was. What do you think about, like, we kind of been on this, but, like, I think this actually can impact politics and culture at the local level. Like, I'm not very political at the national level, but the local level, I get it. And I think most people would do better to go to, like, nicely threatening your town council is probably more beneficial than just voting, right? Like, because all you do is put a different person in there, it's going to use the same boilerplate shit otherwise. But I think that, like, people defend what they value.
Correct.
So if you talk to some of the people that are like big national park managers and things like that in Africa now, they say everything's different over the last 25 years as they've gotten more and more into monetizing the value of the animals, bringing in from developed countries hunters who pay a lot of money to hunt, and almost all the meat actually goes to the people. Like, they made the wildlife have value. So the number of poachers declined because I might sneak in there and chop off one rhino horn and sell it to China and get a, you know, 10% of what it actually brings. And I might be okay for like a month. But now there's a system that makes this resource help all of us. And I won't get shot trying to steal a rhino horn. So I'm thinking protecting the resource is a better thing. And I think if we can make these communities bring back the value that they used to have, then people will start defending them again. Because right now, I think there's a lot of people living in these small areas, especially, like, I think one thing that's probably less, I'm not going to say it's not there, but less prevalent where you are than, like, where I grew up in the Northeast is, like, the drugs. Like, mm-hmm. The drugs have destroyed some of these towns. Were amazing little small towns. People were broke, but people had community. People were tight. If you had a problem and you knew one guy, he knew another guy that knew another guy, and somebody was at your house the next day to help you. Like, that's what it was like. And now the people that are still there, people I went to school with that I still talk to, they don't feel that way. They don't give a shit about the place because it's so bad. All they're thinking is there a way for me to get the hell out of here? Why didn't I do it, you know, back when all my schoolmates did 30 years ago when it was easier to leave, and now I'm entrenched in this crap. I literally had people tell me that you cannot walk down the main street of my old town without walking past at least three people selling heroin, including across the street from the police station. Like, and when I was in school, brother, we smoked some pot. I'm just gonna tell you, right? There had to be a cooling off period between joining the military and deciding to join the military before you peed in a cup. I mean, like that. But if somebody had said, yo, man, you know what we should do? We should run up to Tamaqua and score some heroin. They would have just, like, rolled the window down and threw the fucker out of the car and rolled the window back up and forgot they ever knew him. Like that. But by the time I got out of the military 4 years into it, that's how it was already starting to be. And it's just gutted these places. So we have to restore the society, the culture, the economics, everything, or people just won't defend it because they don't care about it.
Well, I think it's property ownership. Really at the base. If you ever go to a Walmart or any of these public bathrooms, there's a reason they're destroyed because the people who are doing it have never owned property. Property ownership. Back to a lot of those towns and a lot of those small places. There's a great article called Socialist Archipelago. It's an old Mises article, but it's a guy from Russia who is writing how these Indian reservations remind him of home, because nobody owns any property and people can't come in and do business because there's too much of a risk. You know, and so I always, the worst thing that has happened, I think, to the, one of the worst things that have happened to traditional families is the need to make that tax, to pay for the taxes that require both parents to be out of the home. That is, I think, you know, other than drugs or alcohol, whatever's the center vice that has really destroyed both a lot of the traditional families. And it all comes to back down to what is actually your property, what it actually belongs to you. And does your kid own property? You know, they always say the oldest kid typically is the one that becomes the entrepreneur, because when the other kids show up, they try to take all their crap. I've seen this before. So it's, they don't have a sense of property and they don't have a sense of ownership of even themselves, because then they end up getting on the dole and they end up, generational. And there's really no sense of ownership of themselves, let alone their own property. And you think about it, that was also an issue that was slavery, is that the first change of slavery, and I've used this quote before, is that create dependency. Mm. It wasn't the chain, is that if we can create this dependency, then where are they going to go? And they're just going to vote for a new master, as if that means freedom every 4 years. But the slavery part doesn't change. At the end of the day, if somebody has a legal right to your property to put you in a cage, if you resist, you're in a slave relationship. And, you know, they talk about the social contract. And I said, you know, the only type of contract that says that when you have kids that they have to abide by this type of situation is a slave-based contract, you know. And so that might be a bridge too far for some people, but it's true. And so it's really, you want to see people take off, let them know where their legacy is moving forward, let them know where they came from, give them a sense of purpose that they're willing to suffer for, let them have access to property that belongs to them, and stand back and let them become independent, and they'll become ungovernable.
Yeah. I was trying to throw a comment in there about how this really did hit where I grew up, and for some reason YouTube thinks it's terrible and it's rejecting it. But I'm not trying to be mean, but it's a brain drain, and it just kills the population. As people leave like that, because the people that stay are the ones that can't leave or don't care enough to leave. Like, they have no ambition. And I looked up last year around graduation time, how many students were in the graduation class of Pottsville High School where I graduated. And I had to estimate it. I couldn't find the number, but the estimate was somewhere around 150. So when I went to school, we graduated about 500 kids per class. We had about 2,000 in the high school. And we had to do that out on the football field because there wasn't room otherwise, right? And then I look at this graduating class last year, 2024, and they're in the gymnasium, and they're all the chairs for the class are sitting on the basketball court, and they actually fit there, you know, and parents sit in the bleachers. And it's like, nothing wrong with that, except that if you knew, you know, 35 years ago, that class was almost 4.5 times as big.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out since that happened, two more schools in the area have closed and been folded in. And it's still so that population is in that terminal decline now. And again, like you're saying, like if people don't have if they don't feel like they're a stakeholder in some way, then they don't care. I remember when you were talking about, you know, like the way bathrooms are treated at Walmart and are like, I remember I dated this girl. This didn't last for many reasons. This was part of the mindset of why. But she had an apartment, and I was over at her apartment, and I was like going to cut some stuff up to cook. And I said, "Do you have a cutting board?" She said, "Just cut it on the countertop." I'm like, "It's going to mess the counter. I mean, I'll wash it. So it's not dirty, but it's going to mess the countertop." She goes, "You mean their countertop?"
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Like, you do know you have a deposit. Well, they never give that back anyway. So it was since there was no incentive not to damage a thing.
Exactly.
There was no reason to be inconvenienced by like a $5 piece of wood to not damage a thing. And then the other thing that happens is as people begin to feel that way, it's monkey see, monkey do. So Bill throws the candy wrapper, and that's not that big of a deal. But Tommy throws a soda can, and then Billy throws his freaking Gears iced tea carton, and the next thing you know, it looks like a homeless camp. Mm-hmm. And then people are fucking throwing, you know, appliances they can't get rid of into the same place because that's the dump. That's where all the garbage is, right? And just watch these communities get eaten by this. And I really think it's a combination of things. One is that. The other is as they become more developed – how do we develop now? We put in a subdivision. We build just ratty ass cheap houses. Like one guy I follow on X, the only thing this dude does is go around and look at new builds and film them. And he's like, this is a $500,000 new build. And the sticks are just up. It's framed. And there's gas. Like, I'm like, I'm not that good of a freaking carpenter, man. But I could do better than that, right? There's a $1 million house. You know? You're like, so they build a house like that. That house is going to start literally falling to pieces in 20 years. That's bad. But then we build 50 houses in this one subdivision, all within 1 to 2 years of each other. And then what happens? The whole place begins to fold in. So all the people at the bottom of starter homes, if they've done well enough, they say, fuck this, I'm not fixing this. And they move out. And then people that are trying to get started have no money, have to pay all the appreciation on that part. They buy it and they can't fix it. And the neighborhood goes to shit. Like, this type of pattern is just repeating itself over and over and over. And so nobody's like, hey, I'm worried about this house being here in 100 years. Nobody's worried about that house because we all know we're dead by then, right? Like the sun might as well be burning out at 101 years if you're worried about a 100-year house, right? We're not thinking about my grandson might have this house someday. We don't think that way anymore. And I think a lot of it is the cultural problems, but it also goes back to fiat. It goes back to fiat money.
Yeah.
Fiat money equals fiat production.
Yeah. Short time. You brought it up briefly, and I know you're familiar with it, but short time preferences.
Yep.
You know, and it's if you go to Japan or a lot of these other places, it's different. You know, they're willing to make the sacrifices generations later. But I really think that short time preference of money has really jacked us up. And especially if you don't, even if legacy is out the window, you're de-incentivized. I mean, what is it now? Acceptable for what? 5% inflation, 4% inflation is what the acceptable. Okay, do that in 10 years. What is that?
Mortgage like? 2, but if it's 4, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so what does that look like in 10 years? Why would you keep that money? You know, and I tell people, you know, this is a simplified version, but let's say you got a freeze dryer. Okay. And you went down to Aldi's and you bought a flat of strawberries. Okay. I actually have a picture on my Facebook of my daughter putting her arm around a flat of mushrooms. You know, it's one of the things, if you know how to cook, kids will love them. But let's say you dehydrated, let's say you freeze dried all of them and you had enough where you're like, look, I'm never going to have to buy strawberries again, no matter what fiat does, no matter what the price of strawberries does, no matter if we go to war and we can't get them in. There's one thing, no matter what happens, I will never have to buy again. And I try to get people to think that way when it comes to solar or anything else for production, is if you take a little bit of that money you would typically stick in a 401k and you use it to consume something, buy something you consume that removes you from the market, just one thing. That investment is going to be a lot better than having to deal with the outcome of fiat currency. And as you pointed out before, and I totally agree with you, they're going to demonetize over a period of time. They have to. There's, you know, I love what Doge is doing and some of that stuff. You know, if we have to get into politics, but it's there. You can't. You know, and people talk about, well, my economic models. You ever had an economic model that consumes all of its GDP plus some? And I try to point this out to people. I'm like, look. During the Napoleonic Wars, which was the last wars of privatized government, their biggest 12% was the highest they were ever at. And this is during a country trying to stay alive. We're well over 100% of what we consume for GDP. Yeah. So it's what does that look like, you know?
Yeah. And if they manage to fix it, hold that 4%, just for anybody that's wondering what that really is, 4% over 5 years is 21%. And that's 21% increase in cost, but it's also a 21% devaluation of the money that you saved. So most people aren't going to save $100,000 over 5 years. But if you did, you had to work. This is like you really have to start thinking about things differently. You had to work hard enough to create a $100,000 surplus over 5 years, which is $20,000 a year, to end up with an entire year of the effort stripped away. 20% is roughly 1 year of that effort. So you had to generate enough time, money, and discipline to stack 100 grand to end up effectively with 80. And if you keep going, that compounding keeps happening. If you go out to 10 years of doing that, you're looking at 48% roughly. 48% of the value, almost half, just call it half, half of your effort that you made over a decade was stripped by inflation. And there is no world where that's a sustainable model. Like 10 years, we have 50 years of it now. That's actually impressive that it lasted this long.
Yeah. And you sacrificed how many birthdays, how many, you know, how many things that you're never going to get back to do that. I mean, I was a hellion on my second deployment, other than the fact that I was stop loss and I wasn't allowed to hang out with the other E4s. They put me in a tent with fives and sixes because I had a tendency to, my thing was, is after my first deployment, Iraq was kind of hard on me because we got to see. It's different if you're holding enemy troops versus people who are there because Kosovo was hard because it was genocide. And it was like we had the worst scum because it was a NATO mission. So we had genocides. We had mass murders. These are people that decided to be there, not somebody who got conscripted and just happened to be on the other side or actually think they're fighting a good war. So I'm trying to think of the point I was making. But basically, you have to – understand that it's when basically you're going to spend the rest of your life. This is why I became a hellion. You spend the rest of your life thinking about decisions you should have made. And my motto was E4, rank disposable, rank devotable. I knew enough how to get around the system, but not a high enough rank to be responsible for it.
Yeah.
So they stuck me with a bunch of fives and sixes that I actually brought into the unit because regret was not something I was going to do. I'd rather be dead than staring at my stove, looking at a fire. We always call the time machine. You know how that works, Jack. Stare at a fire long enough, hours go by.
Yep.
Thinking about something that I could have done or didn't do. And unfortunately, if you talk to the PTSD and the guys who end up falling fatal to that, you'll find out the reason they do is not because of what they saw, not because of what they didn't do, but because of what they did while they were over there. And they spend their lives regretting to the point they think it doesn't have value anymore and they take their life. So regrets are poison. So
I agree.
Yeah.
This has been pretty good. Let's wrap up with one more question and we'll do some Q&A from the audience.
Yeah.
We've talked about this a lot, but do you want to kind of sum up here at the end? What do you think is the big flaw in this consumption model of retirement that we've been, you know, hitting here and there all the way through?
So, you know, I just take it back to bread and circuses to some extent. I think a lot of people don't realize as middle class, legacy is an option. A lot of times you see these pictures of these people coming across, you know, into the United States and stuff. They think, you know, keeping up with the Joneses, we have to understand that we've been sold a lie. The picket fence and pink house is something that could have been done in Europe. The only thing that made us different as Americans is that you could own property and be productive, which was set us up from different from Europeans.
Yep.
And so now we're trying to keep up with the Joneses. I didn't get into the reason so much why we left our old homestead, but I can tell you that somebody moved in that actually helped us do things, which was no longer they thought were legal once they realized they had to sell their house. They actually pick colors for buildings where they try to sue us from not having the proper colors.
Okay.
These people, I don't think they're inherently bad people. I think they're like most people. But the point I'm trying to make is that they were willing to mow so much grass that they even mowed onto our property, although they could not afford milk for their children.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't get it. And so people say, you know, when do you think it's going to be really bad? We used to talk about, well, the stores not having food or this not.
Yeah.
I really tell people when it bothers you that you can no longer put gas in your lawnmower. That's when you know it's really bad. Because people are willing to sacrifice for consumption and for looks. And not only that, but they're also doing it to their children's future. You know, somebody who's a big anti-free market and the rich and stuff like that. I'm like, well, you're willing to destroy all this stuff and your kids will never get a chance to ever be rich. You're okay with that. I understand that you're okay being poor, but you're okay with them being poor too, you know? And so I think the consumption model and destroying the idea of legacy and thinking that we're sacrificing to get ahead. And, you know, you brought it up. I never thought about it. How the baby boomers and how they're trying to maintain this pharmaceutical drug commercial.
Yeah.
Retirement. with the 80s music in the background, but
yeah,
it's not maintainable, and it's not even for the fact that it's not maintainable. You should not want that for yourself, and you shouldn't want it for your kids, because if your kids have a sense of purpose, the amount of suffering they'll have to do in their life they'll be better, and they'll be ready for it. So yeah, I guess that, I don't know if that answers your answer, but
no, it does. I think it's just, we have what I refer to as perverse incentives. And I mean, everybody in the world has had a job where you had to do something in that job that you really didn't think was right. It may not have been illegal. It may not have been punching a baby in the face, but you really didn't want to do it. And not because it was physically difficult. I'm not talking about, hey, go dig a hole over there. Nobody really wants to dig that hole, but you know what I mean? Like, I have to treat somebody a certain way. I have to hold somebody to some level of expectation that's unreasonable. I have to leave my family. There has to be something you had to do in your life that you feel that way about. Now, just understand that happened to the whole world, specifically the developed world, right here. And those same – why did you do it? If you really didn't want to do it, why did you do it? Because if I got fired, I didn't have a paycheck, and I had to live in a box, right? That's the answer, right? Well, there's different ways to phrase it, but – next 5 years looking for another opportunity. So I did the thing that I had to do to get through the job. We have made society think that way. And I think a lot of it is that the boomers are now chasing the retirement they saw their parents have. And they expect, I did all the things. I did all the things that I was told to do. And now where's mine? And some of them are still clawing it out. Some of them aren't. Some of them are finding that that's not there anymore. Like the people that are retiring the way that I'm talking about, they're people that were making $100,000 in the 90s or more, mm-hmm. a lot more money than it is today, right? They were in that high income bracket at the end of their careers, and they were able to get that retirement. But that retirement they have, it actually looks like the retirement of the guy that worked construction on the highway in the 50s. Right.
Correct.
They have now the same retirement, right? So even the people that think they made it, no, the people that were making the kind of income adjusted that you were when you were at the end of your working life, those people, you didn't even see them when they retired. They went out and bought 3 Chris Craft boats. They had a home over in freaking, you know, Lake Tahoe or some shit like that. Like, we have had this entire erosion behind the scene because the opulence reached was never real. It was artificially reached by that one, you know, that really 1.5 generations that bridged that gap.
Correct. Perfect storm.
The perfect place. You had a high of the nation. We were in a fourth turning. You know, everything was great. We built the highway systems. Computers got developed. Blue collar workers. You know, there were people that didn't do well, but that's because they didn't want to work. If you wanted to work in the 1950s and 60s, you had a fucking job. And if you wanted overtime, you got some overtime. Like if you were that guy, and I remember my dad, I figured out the income my dad was making in like the late 60s. He was making the kind of money that a general practitioner doctor was making. That's how much equality of income there was at that time. But he was working 80 hours to do it, but he could do it if he wanted to.
Right.
Right. But annually he was making the same money as like a small town doctor, which is insane when you think about it. And of course it couldn't stay that way. And I remember when I started in the world of communications and ended up in the outside plant world, it's basically a construction job, even though it sounds fancy because it involves fiber optics. I realized at that point in the mid-90s, I was making the money that my father made in the late 60s, early 70s. I was making the same money, effectively doing the same job. Different infrastructure, but the same job. And you look at that now and you go, we think it's a problem that you don't make that kind of money anymore, but the real problem was that was artificial in the first place. That wasn't real. And as long as we're chasing that ghost, it's not coming back. It doesn't mean things can't be really good, but it's not coming back that way. It will never be that. You will never have a place again where a guy digging a ditch on the side of the road is making the money of a freaking MD that's been practicing for 10 years. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. No. And, no. You know, it's, you know,
here's the thing, and this is another troll position, but we have a lot of people with bread and circus, right? And
yeah.
they'll know everything about their football player, you know, where he went to high school, how many miles he can run, his, you know, his speed in the 60 or whatever. And it's times where I'm not a bread and circus guy. My wife likes college football, but I'll go in and I'll be like, oh, that's great. So what's your kid's favorite color? Yeah, you're a piece of crap parent. You know? And so I'm sure the people in the 50s that are actually, you know, especially if they had the one income, were probably more tied to a traditional nuclear family. So it's, yeah, I know exactly
where I'm from. That was also when men started working like that, though, and working 70, 80 hours because they could make that money. And, you know, we have a very traditional household in the country of mom stayed home, dad went out to work. But but traditionally, dad came the hell home at 5 o'clock.
Exactly. He didn't stay out with his friends trying to build endorphins because he hates his job so much.
Yep.
That's right. As a homesteader, that's where I want to be. I want to be at home. You know, and the other thing is, I think it's unique as a homesteader. And I didn't really go much into the motivational speech stuff during this broadcast. But if anybody wants to come see it, you're welcome to come see it at the expo. But when you start talking to people, and I'm very quiet a lot of times if I'm not around on homesteaders, but when you start talking to people about the life you live and why you live that way, you'll see them, regardless how much money they make, even a lot more than you, you'll see them start talking about their family, but in an apologetic manner. And these are good people, and I don't ever want to put somebody off like this. I'm very hard on myself to get myself moving. But they'll like, well, you know, when I talk about my kids being homeschooled or all the rest of the stuff, they'll talk about their kids. Well, we didn't do that, and they'll sound apologetic, and then they'll go in. You know, but at the end of the day, we always joke with homeschooling. I say my goal is to make kids I like to be around, kids that are incompatible with tyranny, and kids I don't have to apologize for.
And
we saw during COVID, it was awesome. We saw during COVID, I have these strangers in my basement with my last name and I've never met them before. Please send beer because I can't deal with them anymore. And, you know, from a troll piece, I always go, well, thank God for concealed carry. And they go, why? I go, because if you don't know who they are, how they act, and haven't trained them to act efficiently, when they become adults, I might have to deal with that situation. I know you love them, but you had your chance.
Let's hit some questions here from people and some thank yous. Homestead Heathen, thank you for the super chat. And he says you're talking about some of his favorite shows of TSP. That was at the beginning. Great stream. Thanks for the discussion. Thank you, Anarchy, for the super chat. Question from Jesse. What is the name of the solar mini split?
Yeah, so as anything Chinese made, it's probably all made from the same plant. The ones I use is Hot Point it's the name of the company, and you can find it. Yeah. A lot of times maybe HVAC guys out there, but like they should have like a SEER of like 22, 23, but if you get on Hot Point's website, they even have ones that if you live in a cabin and you don't even have batteries, like my whole house is off grid. Yeah. I have a 3,000 pound forklift battery in my basement, which I wouldn't do again, but at the time it was cheaper than lithium. Now there's better reasons to go for lithium. Won't bother right now, but is they even have ones that don't require batteries, which means they work when the sun's out. And so if you really still want that ability, because normally here in Iowa, and I'm sure in Texas, normally when it's hot, the sun's out. They have many different options, different voltages. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Jeff says, this is not really germane to this episode. I'll do it real quick on it. Would you take some of your 401k shares from work and put it into Bitcoin? And can I do it without paying taxes? It depends. Like this is the taxes thing. If you're in a Roth 401 and your company doesn't have a restriction from you pulling money out of it while you're still there, which is probably not the case, then maybe you can. Would I do it? I don't know. And I can't answer that. I'm not your financial investment manager and I don't know the rest of your life. And I probably wouldn't do that because you sound like you're FOMOing to me. So I don't really encourage FOMO. Same guy says, can I talk more about Texas local regs and how homesteaders can do to improve their local regulations? Again, this is really a show for this guest. I'll just tell you that in our state, the most valuable thing you can do for yourself is live somewhere other than whatever county Corsicana is in, because they have their own problems because of the super collider bullshit that they brought a bunch of boilerplate in for. Anywhere unincorporated, you can do anything you want. But then the very first thing you need to do is reach out to all your neighbors and form a coalition that says, we shall not be annexed, because they have a real big tendency around here to once you develop your area to the point where it's got enough tax resource to be worth it, these other towns that are adjacent like to try to annex you, and they let you vote on it, and they will often formulate it to the idea, do you want to become part of town A or town B? And like, you have to pick one. No, you don't. And you need to like fortify the backbone of your community. Do you like it the way it is? Yeah, then there's no reason for us to add another line item to our tax bill and have somebody else tell us how to live. You've got to gin that up. That's what I did. I got the hell away from places where basically you had this, like right down the road from me is a city that acts like an HOA. Dude, there's a guy, he was on our next door. He was pissed. He was selling his Corvette, gorgeous Corvette. So this is not like some jalopy or something. And he lives on a corner lot that's on the main drag that goes through. So he parks his car on a 45-degree angle with a for sale sign it on his own grass. He got a ticket for parking in his own lawn by the police, not by an HOA. Like that town is so effed in the head, they don't need an HOA. They've turned their town council into an HOA board. Mm-hmm. Don't go try to change that shit. Just pick somewhere they haven't already done that. You know, if you're stuck there, then try to change it. Builder of the Castle says, in the future, we need to build houses for multiple people, multiple families, multiple generations to live together. I think that would be great. Or the compound model. Like, I think tiny houses have a place there. No? Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I agree. We're going to – so, yeah. So, on our property, eventually – we will be building a small secondary home when me, my wife, and my other daughter and her husband move in to take over the production model. I don't need that big house because I don't have all the kids. And anyone who's done homes, at least, I don't know, I'm going to make an assumption, but the idea of a tiny home once you get older and you still get to keep your production model with your family is awesome. There's tons of stuff. You know, let me have my weight room in the basement and let me have somewhere to turn a wrench where I don't have to worry about ducks getting into antifreeze, which just recently happened. Anyway, just had a point. Yeah, that was a humbling.
Yeah.
One of the worst part with animals. Yeah, I don't want to get sideways here, but one of the worst part with animals is when you either have to put them down or they die piece of something you could have prevented. That's gut-wrenching because you realize that you screwed up and you caused somebody to die, especially if you have little kids and you're used to yelling at them for doing stupid things and then dad goes out and kills them.
Does something stupid.
Yeah. Anyways, beside the point. But yeah, we plan to put a small secondary home, a small tiny home when we plan to move out. So I definitely agree with that.
Got to agree about us being the old man living in a little house and the family living in a big house. But for the younger people, like, you can build that house so that when your kid's in that transitional stage, they can move out, but they're still with you. And they can have all of that ability to have some autonomy and keep stacking money so they can build their own thing, whether it's across the road from you, down the road from you, another town over, or on
the Amish do it. The Amish do it.
You know, and then maybe as things get older, like, you know, especially when you get down, like, usually it sucks, but usually what happens is in a married couple, one goes before the other, and then you're single and you're by yourself, and having family around would be great. I think we do need to be thinking more in a multi-generational model. And I think the problem is people don't want to give up that autonomy, that individual freedom. And I understand that, but things like secondary buildings, secondary housing, tiny homes, small homes, et cetera, allow for both, right? Because I really don't want to be the old man living upstairs in my old home. I just don't. I'm sorry. I don't want to be that if I happen to be the one to check out second. Like, I'm fine with my kid having the place and everything, but I don't want to be, like, down to a bedroom. I'd rather have the same space detached, I guess, is the way I'm saying it.
We built a bivouac in our barn at the last home for my Marine, never been depressed, enjoys being out in the jungle type father-in-law. So we had to give him a separate space because he's just that type of guy. He's not living with us. He's living here, but not with us because it's just part of his person. He has to be able to come and go as he wants, you know, be able to have what he wants and stuff.
Well, if you think about it, no matter if you travel, like when we travel, I almost never stay with somebody.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's just disruptive. Like, you know, I want to sit down and watch TV. They're watching TV. I don't want to interfere with it. They have their routine. I don't want to interrupt their routine. It's 7 o'clock at night and I have to go downstairs for something. And now I'm walking through family time or whatever. Like, we'll usually get our own place, even if we have people there we want to hang out with, so that there is a point of separation. And I think that can be maintained. I think we know how to do this. It's not hard. New Old Man says, we live in a small town. It's now in the path of rapid development from the city. What would you do in that situation?
So you got two options. Of course, leave, but that's already know that one. But the other option is that I think a lot of people want to be more like the large cities, is because the vision of it being something else is something they've never heard before. It's not that isn't tangible. It's like, look, if you've never been to the East Coast or some of these small places where the Mennonite and the Amish run these small towns, the idea that we could do that and that we could do it is something that they've never thought before. Because you have to understand, they're still running a consumer-based model. They're just doing it as a small town. How can we consume more? How can we consume more? Not how can we produce within the niche that we can produce to drive economics here? So a lot of, like, on my town, there's a Missouri Valley Facebook page. It's kind of almost like the public square, where I try really hard not to troll because I don't want to be kicked out of it. And I kind of do a small business thing for my homestead. So, but you can present these ideas. And then also, you can set up a separate page for that. This is, you know, concerned citizens. So you can be a little more blunt, but a lot of times the ideas we're talking about right now have never been discussed at the level that is allowing this to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the place where, you know, I'm not the political guy, but maybe you get a little bit political and you'd be going to these county commissioner meetings or these town council meetings and go, just before we do this, does anybody really want this for any reason other than you think you'll make more money? How is our life going to be better because we allow this to happen? It's a very simple question, but it's the kind of question that it's not a yes, no, right? Like, this is something that requires some thought and some nuance. And one thing that's interesting to me about these, like, town councils, county commissioners, or whatever, when you're able to speak at those, the people that hear you, and I'm not talking about the elected people, all the people around you, they're the ones that actually pay attention to what's going on. They're the ones that you know, actually are driving a lot of the decisions. They're the ones that are vocal. And sometimes they've never even considered that, you know, something that simple. Like, what will this really do for us? I know they said what they said it will do. But for you, how do you envision Bill, Tom, Mark, Frank, like, you small town, you know these people, right? How will your life get better because of this? How will this make it more likely that when your kid grows up, they'll be able to buy a house like you have? And if it won't do that, then why are we doing it? This is an interesting question. It's not, and you're not coming at it for them to say, we shouldn't do this because. People instantly when you throw something at somebody and they're kind of in the one direction, you push the other direction, they do resistance. I used to do sales training, and I'd get all these sales reps together and have them all stand up and have everybody face somebody, partner up. You tell, you know, people on the left, put your hand up. People on the right, put your hand up. People on the right, push the person's hand on the left. And inevitably, almost everybody did this. Like, it was a standoff, right? Like, and I'm like, before I said that, I said, do exactly what I tell you. And I'd say, okay, who felt resistance? And everybody with the right hand, you know, and everybody on the left, who gave resistance? Everybody, did I ever say to resist? And everybody look at each other like, shit, he didn't, just like Simon says for adults, right? Like, why did you resist? Because when somebody pushes, you resist. When you ask the question without determining the answer, that says, I would like to hear what you have to say about this. And people love to fucking talk, especially the kind of people that go to those meetings. They love to talk. And it is even less what they say that moment and more when they're drinking coffee and going out the back door, what they say to each other. That's where that difference gets made.
Yeah, there's a YouTube video called Things Black Swan. It's the name of a company. And they teach you how to talk to people to get what you want. And it's not through manipulation. But he says almost every situation that we try to set up for somebody, we try to get them to actually say no is the answer we're looking for. Hmm. Because when people say yes, they feel like they're entrapping themselves.
Yeah.
So rather than saying, can I get a perk for this room? Like, is there any way that I could possibly, you know, is there any way, like, is this where I'm stuck at? Can we, you know, and you try to get them to actually say no.
Yeah.
Versus say yes. And it, there's no means I have options.
Yeah.
And so they're a lot more likely to say it if you can word the question properly.
Right. Rather than, do you want to get out of here? The only way we can do that is this. Are you okay with doing this? That's, you've now funneled them down to a singular answer. And even if the answer you're giving them is the one they're going to come up with, now they don't want it. Because you did it, right? You did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
James Von James with a $5 super chat. Thank you, sir. He says he is from Norfolk, Nebraska, and appreciated the discussion of community. Thanks to both of us. And now we got Jeff T. One more question. We'll let you go. Has anybody read the book, The Lost Ways, that keeps showing up on YouTube? Is it a scam? It was good. If it was good, I would get it. I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, I'm just a Firefox. I can't tell you. Get the Firefox collection. It's like it's like Encyclopedia Britannica for homesteaders.
So. Yeah, I have the whole set. Yeah. Upstairs.
I married a white. I married a hillbilly shirt. I think they issue it at birth. So.
Yeah, I had a guy tell me early on. I think I was about 18 months into doing the show. He goes, "You're not a survivalist. You're Foxfire." I'm like, guilty. That's fine.
Oh, yeah.
You can call me whatever you want to. Hey man, I really appreciate you being with us today. I'll give you a chance to close out with whatever you want, but I do want to let people know you've got like Facebook pages, you've got websites, you got all kinds of resources that I have here, and I will make sure all of that is in the show notes. And if there's anything you know you didn't put on your app, pop it over to me while I'm in production and I'll get it into the show notes. But what do you want to kind of wrap up with?
So, two things. One of them is actually going to be a tool that we teach in the class. If you want to play with solar, there's a website out there. Yes, it's a government website, and yes, it actually works really well. This isn't a Fed. I'm not a Fed.
Yeah.
There's a website out there called PVWatts. I think it's .gov. You do a search for it, so they may have changed it, but you can still find it. What it does is it basically pulls all the weather stations in your area. When you put your zip code in, you can even do a satellite shot. It's not important if you wanted to set up. But you can, this website is so powerful that my wife can say in 4 years from now in December, when should I make, turn on the crock pot?
Okay.
And it will do it. It is that strong because it breaks down the data from month to day to minute to hour. It just does it. It just does. It's great. And the thing is that what you can do is you can set up a simulation because it'll ask you like what size array you have. Now, here's the only trick on the website. I tell people when you put your zip code in, it's going to give you your latitude. If you are building a solar array and you don't plan to tilt it up or down, and you want to keep it at a fixed point, you want to put it at your latitude. That's going to be the best for winter and summer. So when it asks you your latitude, you will know what your latitude is because when you put your zip code in, it gives it to you.
Okay.
If you put your latitude in as your tilt angle for your panels, you'll get the information you need. Now, if you put plus or minus 15% from what they give you, you can do winter and summer tilt and see if it's worth your effort. Well, in my class, I show what the difference is in outcome. If you're a homesteader and you're off grid, put it at winter tilt. The reason is because if you can make enough power in winter, you'll make enough power in summer, and you're not sticking it back on the grid. So just leave it at winter. That will allow you to make an array that is fixed, which is more wind resistant than making one that is tiltable, that has a built-in, you know, tiltable. But the reason I say that's really important, the reason I'm hammering hard, is because the default latitude they give you is horrible.
Okay.
It'll just default to it. And so don't use it. Just go and put it. And that way you can run simulations because the thing will tell you how much AC your DC array will put out.
Okay.
So you know exactly how much electric, and it already puts in like bird crap, clouds, and all the rest of stuff.
Okay.
So that's a nice tool to have. The other thing is that we talk about the different, I appeal to both preppers and homesteaders. For me, the difference is preppers are playing Jenga, where homesteaders are playing with Legos. They're trying to design a system that deals with this Jenga tower falling over, where homesteaders are trying to design a system where that system doesn't even matter anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the difference in legacy. And everybody goes through that transition most of the time. You have a lot of, I do ham on occasion, but someone said buying trinkets, survival trinkets and putting them in your closet. I'm like, I've been a little guilty of that. That's kind of what preppers do. And so just try to move over from not worrying so much about that system and moving over to actually trading the Legos. If I always tell people politics,
I said, you know, regardless if your side wins or not, go ahead and tell me that your great grandkids will live as free as you did in the 80s. And if you can't say that, then you're wasting your time at the ballot box.
So, yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. I would like what you're kind of finishing with there is like the difference between self-reliance and self-sufficiency. And I've always said self-reliance is the bridge to self-sufficiency.
Correct.
And your self-reliance in time, the trinkets, even when they're just highly effective things like a generator with, you know, 80 gallons of gasoline gives you a time level that you can have power until either the system comes back or you get more gas or fix your broken ass generator. Self-sufficiency is the thing that's measured in percentile. So if I have a solar powered system, yeah, they have a life expectancy and all, but I mean, it's long. So now if I'm getting 60% of my energy from a solar array, then I'm 60% self-sufficient for energy.
Yeah.
Right. And that one can be the bridge to the other, but if we're not using it as a bridge, it's a crutch, right? You're never correct. Actually getting anywhere and you're always treading water. It's the antlion, you know, I don't know if you know what antlions are, but mm-hmm. they're all over when I was a kid growing up in Florida and, you know, it's this little divot in the sand and an ant falls in that divot and it starts trying to get out and that antlion starts just spitting dirt at him. And the harder he runs, the faster he ends up eating. And the only way out is to never go in, or the ants that did get out were the ones that really like just said, fuck this, it ain't happening, not today, Satan, and they're out, right? Like they go 100% all the way. You can't go halfway with it. And I know that because I was a twisted little kid and we were bored. We were Gen X. It was the 80s. So we used to go pick up ants and put them in.
Brandon done that.
Yeah, this one can get out. No. Anyway, man, I had a great time talking to you. I'll make sure, again, all the stuff that you sent me for the show notes is in the links section of the show notes for people watching the live stream. Right down there in the video notes, there's a link. You click that link. You get over to the audio version on my website. If you are watching it live and you click it right now, you know what's going to happen? Nothing, because we're not done yet. We're almost done, but we're not done yet. And it takes me about 30 minutes after we wrap to get that all done. So, hey, John, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah. One quick thing real quick.
Sure.
We have the expo coming up on the 21st and 22nd. This is just, you know, guilty advertisement. A third of our ticket sales are out of state.
Okay.
So if you do Homesteaders of Iowa, you can find that. You'll have the link down there.
Okay.
The lady who's putting this on, phenomenal. So definitely be with your time. And a lot of it has to be, if you're like, look, I'm a homesteader. I know everything. And a lot of homesteaders get to the point. You don't know networking. I'll be talking about Noster. Jack, you need to get that class up and together so I can get some free stuff out of it rather than having to beat it up. But I'll be talking about that only about like 15 minutes just so people know what it is and know it's out there and know that it's aware of it. So if they decide to use Facebook, it's their own fault.
Yeah.
So that's all I got.
Yeah, definitely. I try to tell people at events, man, it's the person sitting next to you is more important than the person on the stage, man.
Yes.
Get on it. Get to know people. Hey, man, John, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, guys, real quick before we wrap up, let's go ahead and take care of our housekeeping at the end of the episode. You guys know if you want to support my show, it's a really easy, simple way to do that. You can, of course, become a member of the MSB. I really appreciate when people do that. And that's the main way I pay the bills around here. They go to the survivalpodcast.com, click on members, and you can sign up there. And the discounts you get will more than pay for your cost of membership. I promise you that. If you use them, some of you guys don't. You say you're not worried about it. But, you know, it's value on both sides. Like the supporting vendors, the partners that offer the discounts, they're relying on you using it. So it's important to not only become a member, but actually use the membership, at least when you're buying things you're going to buy anyway. And then the other side of this is you can, when you're going to buy something, even if it's not from one of our partners, you can go to tspaz.com first. No matter what you buy, if you start there, you will help us out. And everything there is things to make your life better. They are personally tested by me. If I wouldn't spend my money, I will never ask you to do it. Today's item of the day is Dynomyco Premium Mycorrhizal Inoculant. It pays for itself in the added production that you get because of it. When I started using this a few years ago and combining it with biochar in my starts, I started getting these plants. If I was starting them in like a red solo cup, I've got a freaking pepper that's about 3 inches tall, big stocky looking, but little pepper. And when you pulled it out of that cup to put it in the ground, that root system completely made that you know, beer drinking party cup into a plug. I had never seen root systems form like they did when I added this to my fertility regime. And it's because that first association that plant wants to make is with fungi. This is the product for that. If you use it according to the directions, it's kind of expensive. The one little bag will cost you about $38, and they'll tell you to do 38 plants. It is a living organism. You do not need that much of it. This is mainly sold to people that grow cannabis indoors, okay? And they have produced some of the best ag stuff on the planet because it's high-value product. I use about a quarter teaspoon per plant with this to get the results that I do because it's life, and life begats life. In the write-up today, I tell you exactly how to use it as well. So check that out. I also have another thing I want to let you guys know about, and hopefully it won't start making a bunch of noise here. I can silence it real quick and bring it back up. But I've been playing with some AI tools lately, and I found this one through Josh Hale that we just had on called Notebook LM, and it's made by Google. And I'll have – it'll go out – it went out my social media today. It'll go out my Daily Mail today. I took this PDF that I've been recommending. Since 2009, I've recommended this PDF. It's by Bill Mollison, and it's really not by him. He taught a PDC here in Florida at a place called Barking Frogs Permaculture back. I was like 93 this happened. And somebody transcribed a whole series, not the whole thing, but a whole series of his lectures from that PDC into this PDF. I took this PDF, I dropped it in a notebook LM, and I said, I want you to make me a conversational podcast discussing this and the practical applications of it for people. I've probably read that PDF 24 times over the years. It's that good. I'm not going to say you're going to get the same experience, but you get a lot of the highlights, and it's pretty cool. Like, because it took me about 10 minutes to set it up.
Citrus, grapes, even melons.
Melons in the desert.
That's delicious. What you get.
He even had some interesting ideas about aquaculture in arid landscapes.
He did.
Aquaculture in the desert. That sounds counterintuitive.
It might seem that way, but
if you want to listen to the whole thing, I made a YouTube video out of it so it would be easy to share. That'll go out in the Daily Mail. So one last plug before I leave. Daily Mail. If you don't want to miss anything, get on the Daily Mail. You get one email a day from me, work days anyway, about five a week. And it's just a list of the things that were created or known that day and a link. That's all that it is. And if you're not on the Daily Mail, you will miss things like sometimes I find really good deals that sell out as soon as I drop them and things like that. That or the Telegram group. Anyway, you can learn all about that at thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on Get Social to know more. And I will catch you guys tomorrow with an expert council Q&A show for the week. I got a really great lineup for you already set up for tomorrow. Friday flashback on Friday. And we'll do it all again starting Monday.
They said you should have a house via American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.